Okay, so this chapter, chapter 2, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti, here Sri Aurobindo is following up on the previous one, and he's trying to relate the reality to its origin. So what we experience of the world, and his premise, which he has made earlier, that there is an infinite being that has become all this. And so this infinite being, which is radically infinite and hence supracosmic, has become this universe in some way. But whatever way it has become is something that is not clear to us. It has ordered the universe in some way, but also this ordering is not clear to us. We seem to intuit an order in the universe, but we also can see it configured as a chaos. Both these explanations of the universe seem to coexist. And then if we think about a radical infinity, we see that it does not lend itself to any kind of rational order. So the question arises as to, you know, are we to take this as something which lends itself to determinability, a determinate, or is it radically indeterminate? And in the last chapter, Sri Aurobindo has gone through this issue, which is the primary issue of knowledge, of epistemology. And there he has shown that there is a certain premise on which he is working. And that premise becomes explainable through, I mean, that premise becomes validated through experience. And what are the kinds of experiences necessary for that? This is what the previous chapter was about. And then here, the premise is one of the involution of that being, of the conscious being. And this involution is expressed by Sri Aurobindo in the previous chapter in a philosophical manner. But it also is expressed by him elsewhere in his interpretation of the Veda as the sacrifice of Purusha. Now, in this particular chapter, he is looking at the ways by which that absolute existence has become all this that there is. And when we talk about all this, he is looking at it in terms of three terms of existence. And these three terms are being, which is supracosmic, ultimately infinite, radically infinite, cosmos, which is the self-expression of being in terms of a kind of an infinite container, what he has called a bounded infinite. You see, in other words, it's an order of infinity within which some kind of idea may generate itself, a plane of consistency. And then there is the entities within the cosmos, which are the individualized forms of consciousness. So there are these three terms by which we have to look at this entire reality. And to these three terms, there are three statuses of being. So as he pointed out in the last chapter, that there are a number of triplicities. These triplicities originate in an originary triplicity, which has to do with being, consciousness, and bliss. You know, Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Now, of these three, and then each of these three becomes another triplicity, a triplicity of experiencer, object of experience, and the experience itself. Now, here what he's taking is the primary term of the originary triplicity, which is being itself. So if we are going to look at this entire reality, even in its three terms, as radical being, cosmos and entities, we should be able to look upon it, you know, in terms of the primary origin of this entire system as a radical monism, that there is only one. There is, what is that only one? That only one is being. That being has become everything. That being is conscious, hence consciousness belongs to it. That being is blissful, hence bliss belongs to it. That being is the supracosmic infinite, hence the supracosmic infinite is it. That being is the cosmos, it has become the cosmos. That being is every entity in the cosmos, because it has become every entity in the cosmos. Now, this kind of a radical monism requires certain terms to make it explainable. How can we arrive at this formulation of a radical monism in terms of the triplicity of our reality? That is what Sri Aurobindo is approaching in this particular chapter. And he is introducing three new triplicities, one may say. But the three new triplicities are expressed in terms of dualities. Because the triple term is the experience between them. And these dualities are Brahman and Maya, Purusha and Prakriti, and Ishvara and Shakti. So, in those two paragraphs which we have read so far, he has introduced these terms. And particularly the first three terms, which is Brahman, Purusha and Ishvara. He has done that in this part, early in the second paragraph, where he says, the supreme truth aspect which thus manifests itself to us is an eternal and infinite and absolute self-existence, self-awareness, self-delight of being. Here we are going back to the originary three, that is Sat, Chit and Ananda. This founds all things and secretly supports and pervades all things. This self-existence, so here he has now taken from those three, self-existence, self-awareness and self-delight, the primary term, which is self-existence or Sat. This self-existence reveals itself again in three terms of its essential nature, self, conscious being or spirit, and God. So these are the three that he is defining as the essential attributes of conscious self-existence. It has a sense of self. It is a conscious being, beyond even a sense of self. And it is God. Now he immediately realizes that to these terms used in the English language, there are some problems. The major problem being that this is occurring in a dualistic frame. And as soon as he uses the word God, there is already a certain kind of sense of a ontological separation between the creator and the created. And so he modulates it and says, oh, we can't stick with this. And this is a very important key step, because he is immediately creating a cross-linkage between two cultures. And he is showing that we have to open up the lexicon of the Indian heritage and the history of Indian yoga to really understand what these terms may mean in this philosophy. Because as soon as we use terms like self-conscious being and God, we are pushing ourselves into a theological framework that is already given in the Western metaphysical world. So he says the Indian terms are more satisfactory. Brahman, the reality, is Atman, Purusha, Ishvara. So now these are the three terms that are mapping into self, conscious being or spirit, and God. In other words, Atman is self, Purusha is conscious being or spirit, and Ishvara is God. Now, loosely, this is how we understand it even in India today. And partly our understanding in India has taken on this translated quality because the modern mind, including the Indian mind, is already theologically under the impress of a Western understanding of things. So, Ishvara is what we naturally translate it to God. Now, the way Sri Aurobindo is using this term is God seen as the possessor of will. Because the term Ishvara is literally related to the Sanskrit root Ish. Ish, which is also the same Indo-European kind of root that enters into wish, for example, to wish. Ultimately, it is will. And this notion of the willer, the one who has will, is the origin of Ishvara. This is a very key term, because this will be the term, as we'll see in this chapter, that really bridges the sense of original self, the selfhood of Brahman, with the sense of being a conscious person in the cosmos. So, in a way, one may say that the primary reality of Brahman as a supracosmic being is its sense of self. And the primary reality of entities within the cosmos is the sense of consciousness. Because we find ourselves in this cosmos as conscious beings who have a certain root of consciousness, but we also find ourselves confronted by the inconscience and its degrees of unconsciousness, ultimately lapsing into a complete unconsciousness. So we may follow the existentialists who define our existence as being that of conscious beings in an unconscious world. This is our experience, our existential experience. We experience a sense of consciousness inside each of us, but even in our own beings, we experience a lot of unconsciousness. And hence, this root of consciousness by which we define ourselves, to what extent is it related to any originary conscious being? This idea has to be bridged by some intermediate term, a lord of the cosmos, that has some kind of a controlling factor and has become every entity within it. Now, this immanence of the Lord is also its determinability. That's the reason why whatever we call order belongs to a single willing person, that there is a being of will that has become this cosmos and by its will holds the cosmos together. So that is the notion of Ishvara at the supracosmic level, cosmic level, as well as the individual level, bridging these three. So here, Sri Aurobindo introduces these terms, and he also differentiates them from the notion of God in the Western tradition to the notion of Ishvara. And he says that what differentiates these two traditions is that these terms, Atman, Purusha and Ishvara, have a different kind of experience world from which they come. So for these terms grew from a root of intuition. And while they have a comprehensive preciseness, are capable of a plastic application which avoids both vagueness in the use and the rigid snare of a too limiting intellectual concept. In other words, they have arisen out of a poetic sensibility, a true poetic sensibility, not a fanciful one, but a poetic sensibility which belongs to the inner mind that is in contact with the higher planes of cosmic mind, to which this the logical divisioning, a hard logical divisioning, is blurred by the sense of the one. The one and the many coexist within it. So this is the reason why these terms have a certain kind of plasticity, while at the same time being differentiators of experience. See, a differentiator of experience is more like a holographic term. It's a holographic term in the sense that it contains infinite possibilities, but puts forth only one particular face. Behind that face, you can sense the palimpsest of everything else, but at the same time, you see and interact with one. At another point, it may change and present another aspect of itself. So this is the way in which he is expecting us to use our terms and to interact with these concepts. I think then he goes into a very long, almost a Upanishad, one may say, of the monism of Brahman. Everything is Brahman. Brahman, as we said, is the supracosmic existence. Brahman is everything that we can say about the cosmos, and Brahman is every entity in the cosmos. Every entity, each one of us, is Brahman in two major ways, or one may even say in three ways. On the one hand, we are Brahman because the conscious self, the selfhood of the Brahman, has become each one of us through a self-concentration, a partial self-concentration. So we have what we call a soul or psychic being, which is an eternal portion of the Brahman, or eternal portion of the Supreme Being. That is what the Gita says, Amsa Sanatana, eternal portion. On the other hand, this eternal portion is also encased by a particular body of qualities, which body of qualities is the way in which that particular infinity is presenting itself. What is its self-presentation? That body of qualities is determined by the nature of that self-concentration. So that belongs to the second term. In other words, Maya, Shakti, or Prakriti, whatever we want to call it. And so these two together form the psychic being. This is the second term is what he is in towards the end of that long paragraph. He says, the soul or psychic entity is an eternal portion of the Ishvara. That is eternal portion. That is Sanatan, Amsa Sanatana. It is his supreme nature or consciousness force that has become the living being in a world of living beings. Now here, he is re-inflecting that existential formula of being a conscious being in an unconscious world. He's talking about being a living being in a world of living beings. Even matter, from that point of view, is living. Everything is living. And the forms of life that belong to each of these gradations of consciousness is nothing but supreme nature or consciousness force that has become that form. And hence, in our essence, we are a certain form of nature or of consciousness force. That is the body of qualities which belongs to the psychic being. So the psychic being is already a combination or a duality, a unity between the Ishvara and the Shakti. Eternal portion of the Ishvara and the self-becoming or the individual becoming of the Shakti. The Gita uses the term para prakriti jiva bhuta. So para prakriti has become, it's become, bhuta, bhut, to become the jiva, has become the living thing. So this is one way in which we are that thing, and the other way in which we are that thing is the transitoriness of the other bodies, which are also nothing but the self-becomings of Prakriti. So Prakriti has formed the mold of the body, just like a potter forms its pot. The Prakriti has formed the mold of the vital body. The Prakriti has formed the mold of the mental body. And the Prakriti inhabits these as the psychic body. And there is united with the Ishvara, or a portion of the Ishvara, which is sustaining its individuality. So this is how he looks at it, and he ends that long paragraph by bringing in these three terms again. Brahman, the Ishvara, is all this by his yoga maya, by the power of his consciousness force put out in self-manifestation. He is the conscious being, soul, spirit, purusha, and it is by his nature, the force of his conscious self-existence, that he is all these beings. He is the Ishvara, the omniscient and omnipotent all-ruler, and it is by his Shakti, his conscious power, that he manifests himself in time and governs the universe. This is the root of the determinability of the cosmos. These and similar statements taken together are all comprehensive. It is possible for the mind to cut and select, to build a closed system and explain away all that does not fit within it. But it is on the complete and many-sided statement that we must take our stand if we have to acquire an integral knowledge. So this notion of all comprehensibility, these and similar statements taken together, so each of these statements and these statements taken together are all comprehensive. In other words, each one of them is the totality. This is one of the definitions of integral. Integral means that each is everything else. Each is the whole. There is nothing but the whole. The whole has become the part. But the whole does not remove itself from the part. Every part is the entire whole. And if we are to acquire an integral knowledge, we have to keep that in mind, rather than follow the logic which says that the parts are separated and each one has to be taken as an instance, as a mathematics of numerability. See, so this is not a numerable. It is numerable, and at the same time, it is whole. See, the two have to be seen simultaneously. So that's where he ends. If there are any questions or comments, we can take it. Otherwise, we can begin.
Debashish?
Yeah.
This is over.
Yes, sir.
Just a quick question. Ishvara, would the word... Would this be, could it be characterized as Brahman on a personal level, rather than impersonal, or is that not, but it seems, Ishvara and Brahman seem very close, but it seems like it's the element that is within us also, as well as without.
You're right. You see, the thing is that Ishvara refers specifically to the will aspect of Brahman.
Right.
And you may say that that's the reason why he uses the term God to translate it, because there is a personal aspect to it. So it is the supracosmic supracosmic Brahman that is presenting itself, and hence if it is presenting itself to itself, then it does so by a will. But a will already means that there is a certain kind of you know, a matrix of determinability. It's ordering itself in a certain way to will itself into existence. For being to will itself into existence means that he's following a certain kind of plan. It's following a certain kind of idea. So the idea aspect or the self-conception is implicit in the notion of willing. And hence, Ishvara is a self-limitation of the absolute by which it can present itself and come into existence. This already means that it is a person. You see, it is actually becoming, or you may say that it is the originary personhood of Brahman. See, Brahman is already a person. Brahman is not becoming something else, but it is, Sri Aurobindo calls it, an infinite person. A person that is impersonal in its nature because it has infinite possibilities. But that does not abrogate the fact of its being a person. So you are quite right that Ishvara includes the person, but it is also impersonal. It is both at the same time.
Thank you very much.
Devashish, this is John Robert.
Yeah.
Yes, if I understood you when you were talking about the psychic being,
yes,
you said that there was both an aspect of Purusha and Prakriti in that, or there's both this infinite person as well as qualities. Is that right? And I wonder,
yes,
if you could elaborate a little bit. I was very taken by that, and I'd like to hear it maybe again or more in more elaboration.
Yes. So here, you see, I think in this particular chapter, he's used the word psychic being. That's already quite, striking that this is one of the chapters he must have changed later, because he doesn't use that term very often in this book. Of course, he uses it extensively in part 3, where he's talking about the triple transformation. But he actually uses the term over here. What was the part there? The soul or psychic entity, he says over here. He uses the term psychic entity here. And as you know, both Sri Aurobindo and the mother make a distinction between psychic entity and psychic being. Essentially, the difference is this, that the psychic entity, they call it the spark soul. The spark soul is what is, you know, in this terminology, it is the multiple self-concentration of the one. So you may think about reflexivity. In other words, if we were to reflect on ourselves and ask ourselves the question, who am I? And start writing a description of ourselves, like when we do when, you have to write a CV or a bio of yourself. But it's really written not for a purpose, but for all the purposes that you can think of, let's say, an omnipurpose. Then you would reflect on yourself, and you are bringing yourself into existence through that self-reflection. But think of a radically infinite being who turns upon himself to reflect on himself. It doesn't do that upon one, conceiving of itself as one entity. It does that, conceiving of itself as one entity, but also conceiving of itself as infinite entities. Now, we also do that to some extent, because we are multiple beings and we have different sides to us, and we can bring all of these to the front through different descriptions. So these infinite self-conceptions of the one, or self-concentrations of the one, each each one of them is a self-presentation through a certain, form of concentration on itself. This form of concentration creates the spark soul. In other words, I am this little fragment on which I am concentrating. That is then, but that fragment is not a separated fragment. It is nothing but the whole. It's only that the whole is being concentrated on at a certain point. Hence, that whole becomes gradually illuminated. It's at first just a little point. That point is the origin of the psychic entity. Now, that point is gradually being illuminated by the properties by which it is describing itself in space and time. And that we'll come to later, because he's going to bring in space and time. And so that gradual self-illumination or self-exploration from a certain vantage of its own infinite possibilities is being undertaken by its consciousness, which is expanding, the locus of awareness. This expansion leads to a body of qualities, which is what we call the psychic personality. That psychic personality is therefore a point of self-concentration, which is a spark soul or a atom of being, what he's calling Amsa Sanatana, the eternal portion of the Ishvara, and the body of qualities that has developed around it through the self-exploration by awareness, by consciousness. Therefore, that is the self-becoming or individual becoming of the divine prakriti or para prakriti jiva bhuta. These two together constitute what we call the psychic being. This is one of the reasons why the psychic being is the first root of integrality in the person. It's not the mental purusha. The mental purusha is only a purusha. It does not, you see, in this chapter, he will actually be looking at the mental purusha experience as the purusha prakriti division. What I said when I said to be a conscious being in an unconscious world. The experience of being a conscious being in an unconscious world already belongs to the division between purusha and prakriti. But within us resides something in which that division is never there. It overcome because it's the truth. And that truth, though partial, is that of the psychic being, which already contains both Purusha and Prakriti, or Ishvara and Shakti, united within it.
And so would it be fair to say that the psychic being is Purusha as the spark and Shakti as the personality, the psychic personality?
Yeah, absolutely. Purusha is the spark that never changes, that is always inhabiting it, that ultimately is just a self-concentration of the infinite. That is the whole that is looking upon itself as a atom and a body of qualities that is evolving around it. That is the personality of the soul evolving towards cosmicity and ultimately towards transcendence, but following a certain trajectory, which is the trajectory of the Swabhava and the Swadharma that is given to it by the Shakti or the Paraprakriti.
Thank you. That's very, very helpful.
So along those lines, then the experience of the mental purusha, is that what we would call the witness consciousness, or is that something else?
That is the witness consciousness, absolutely. That is the witness consciousness. In fact, in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo is using the term purusha along those lines. that it is the witness consciousness which is watching the execution of a will that has left it, that it no longer has power over. This is the reason why the Ishvara Shakti equation is something that mediates between the Purusha Prakriti equation and the Brahman Maya equation. The Purusha Prakriti equation is one that is already the sundering of a relationship between consciousness and its workings, or the conscious being and its workings.
So, to this mental Purusha, this witness consciousness, is there a evolutionary element to it as there is for the psychic being, or is it more, you know, static?
Well, it is static, but you may say that the evolution of it is one, actually there is a change of status, you may say. In that sense, you may say there is change. I don't know if it can be called evolution, but because the mental Purusha will remain the mental Purusha, but the sense of what is the true Purusha will change. The true Purusha will first become the, that's why, let me back up and say Sri Aurobindo has some interesting things to say about what he calls the central being. The central being in a person is different. You know, all human beings don't have the same central being. He says the central being in each human being is usually one of the three Purushas, the physical Purusha, the vital Purusha, or the mental Purusha. This is what determines what kind of person we are. Some people are predominantly vital. Some people are predominantly mental. Some are predominantly physical. So this kind of stamp to the expression is given due to the central being. All human beings have a certain degree of each of these Purushas that are expressing through the Prakriti. But this has to be replaced, and that's part of the evolution of the psychic being. It's not so much the evolution of the physical Purusha, vital Purusha, or mental Purusha, but the evolution of the psychic being, because it is the personality that evolves. The Purushas don't evolve. The personality evolves because the Ishvara is within the psychic being. It develops power of control over these Prakritis and therefore comes to the front and becomes the central being. So it replaces the central being that is given and becomes the new central being in us. So this is how the evolution, so the status of the Purusha changes. It is no longer what we took to be the Purusha, but now becomes a new Purusha, the Purusha that has control over the nature, and then moves further and becomes the cosmic being that is the Ishvara of the cosmos in control over ourselves, but at the same time holographically knowing that it is the controller of everything else. And finally moving even further and becoming the supramental Purusha. That is the triple transformation. But the evolution takes place not in the Purusha, but in the Prakriti, that by its evolution changes the status and meaning of Purusha.
Yeah, thank you, Devashisla.
And this mental Purusha, is it individualized or, what is the exact difference between mental Purusha and psychic, the Purusha that is, the being part of the psychic being?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good question, because the mental Purusha is the being part of the psychic being, I may say, because in a way, all these three Purushas, mental Purusha, vital Purusha, and physical Purusha, are the antaratman, or the inner Atman, the internal Atman, the Atman that has entered into time and space, seen in a fragmented way due to the maya of avidya. So what is happening is that the sense of being just a conscious witness is also an aspect of the psychic being. And that has become clothed in a certain type of prakriti, which is the mental prakriti. This is the reason why only upon the appearance of mind in nature, in prakriti, the psychic being can actually make its appearance. The human being has the psychic being, because the conscious witness emerges and becomes the essence of the Purusha, the one that is free, the one that is not bound by any prakriti, that is not bound even by its body of qualities, but is the knower of those qualities. So, in a way, you are right that what we call the conscious being, the pure witness, is one of the potentia of the psychic being that has separated itself and become the mental Purusha.
No, I mean, my question was, is the mental Purusha individualized?
It's individualized in that sense, that it belongs to the psychic being, which is the person, the true internal person. It is individualized in that sense, but it is impersonal. So it is from, you know, say, let me give you an example. Say, for example, you know, the question that is asked by some people to Sri Aurobindo, that, you know, the Buddha, he talked about nirvana, he talked about this, you know, no self and this kind of spiritual experience that does not have any need for a person, you know, for the essence of a person, but it is a spiritual experience all the same. But does psychic being play any part in it? And Sri Aurobindo's answer to that was that if the psychic being had not been present, Buddha would not even have thought about the idea that he thought about. In other words, it's a personalized movement that led him to this particular exploration of what might be the mental Purusha. The mental Purusha in and by itself is impersonal, but it is motivated by the person.
So, that way, I mean, psychic beings still hold something which is different from mental Purusha, right? I mean, the being part of psychic being. I mean, also, like, for example, like, when Mother says that new souls were born after that 56 event, I mean, that new souls, I mean, can it be that those psychic beings which are individualized at its own birth in the sense birth, spiritual birth, not like birth on earth, but the sort of self-concentration in a new way, in a new individualized way. That's how I understood as born or birth of a new soul, of the psychic being, which doesn't necessarily have to be, can be devotional or some other qualities, which is little bit different from the mental qualities. So I'm just trying to clarify all these things together.
Yeah, I think as far as new souls, to go back to the origin of your question, yes, the psychic being is not constrained by being a witness. It's not just a witness. It's the impersonal aspect of the mental Purusha belongs to it, but it is not all it is. It is more than that. So when we use the term Purusha, ultimately Purusha means person. That is in fact the root of the word Purusha. If we use it as conscious being, as Sri Aurobindo is doing over here, then there is a certain status of it that he is bringing to mind. That status which is a pure witness. And that status is most manifest in our experience as the mental Purusha. But ultimately it belongs to the psychic being, which is that and more than that.
So, the mental Purusha, I mean, can it be said is like the Purusha that is supporting the principle of mind, like my mental principle? Or is it, and that I mean, like, principle that is part of nature, in general, and then, you know, psychic being can sort of influence, that part of the nature. Or mental Purusha is something completely different.
No, mental Purusha is, there is a cosmic mental Purusha. So it's like the mental Purusha of the cosmic being, which is the support of universal nature. And there is an individualized mental Purusha, which is the mental Purusha that is operating in the individual, not only influenced by the psychic being, but projected by the psychic being. So in just as you may say, when we are talking about a universal mental Purusha, a cosmic mental Purusha, the cosmic mental Purusha is the emergence of the cosmic Purusha in the mind principle. So too, the individual mental Purusha is the emergence of the individual psychic being in the mind principle. The two are related because the individual is also a portion of the cosmic being. And also you may say that the mind, individual mind, is a formulation of universal mind. So it's a kind of a, you know, the going back to the potter and his wheel, Prakriti that is making the body of the mind, the mental body, Manomaya Sharira, that has been created by Prakriti. And then the mental Purusha will inhabit it, but what mental Purusha will inhabit and support it? That is the cosmic mental Purusha, but it is individualized because a portion of that cosmic being has become the individual being, which is each of us. And hence, it is being supported by the mental Purusha that is the project of the individual mental, individual psychic being.
Thank you so much. So that clarifies a lot, actually. So basically, correct me if I'm wrong. So what I'm getting it as, these different Purushas are basically different layers, at an individual level, which is sort of projected from the psychic being. And it is like, psychic being is projecting itself as the mental being, when it is taking up the mental nature, and sort of something like that.
Yeah, that is, it is something like that. And that's the reason why it is possible for the psychic being to come to the front and become the central being. It is not that it actually overrides some other Purusha, but it is its own Purusha, that it, an appearance of its own Purusha, that it ultimately changes the equation. You know, it changes the holographic feature. That's all that it's doing. It's coming, the central being is coming to the front in the sense that it is no longer one or the other of these three. This entire problem of Purushas, many Purushas in each of us and many Purushas in the cosmos, is just a consequence of avidya prakriti, or what Sri Aurobindo calls the overmind maya, avidya prakriti. Avidya prakriti is the way by which avidya has been created by an operation of prakriti. So what that does is that is creating divisions, you know, khanda. That's why in a way it is Kali's sword that creates these divisions as if they are separate things. But ultimately there is only one Purusha. There is nothing but one Purusha and its self-appearances as infinite individualized Purushas three major, you know, avidya purushas of matter, life and mind, infinite, you know, purushas of mind, purushas of life and purushas of body, etc. These are self appearances of divisioning, by which the one purusha appears in the cosmos and as every entity in the cosmos.
Thank you so much.
Devashish, can I ask you? I've thought about this a number of times, but I haven't had a chance to ask you. For example, with the psychic being, Ishvara, Brahman, all of the terms that we're going across and using, is there a good resource? You don't need to tell us now, but if you could think of and maybe let us know, or if you know now, a good resource that either... you know, someone in the Sri Aurobindo movement has put together of terms that are defined. If there's any such resource, that would really...
Yeah, there is a resource. It's called the Glossary of Terms in Sri Aurobindo's Yoga. It's a glossary, and this glossary has been put together. It's been around for a long time. It's a really good book. And in fact, it's been put together using the definitions given by Sri Aurobindo himself. So it's really somebody who has selected explanations that give an explanation of each of these terms.
Excellent. Thank you.
So, shall we start reading?
Sure.
This is page 325, the paragraph starting, An Absolute, Eternal and Infinite Self-Existence. Beverly, would you like to start? Dan Wood, if you're there.
Sure. In absolute, eternal, and infinite self-existence, self-awareness, self-delight of being that secretly supports and pervades the universe, even while it is also beyond it, is then the first truth of spiritual experience. But this truth of being has at once an impersonal and a personal aspect. It is not only existence, it is the one being, absolute, eternal, and infinite. As there are three fundamental aspects in which we meet this reality, self, conscious being or spirit, and God, the divine being, or to use the Indian terms, the absolute and omnipresent reality, Brahman, manifest to us as Atman, Purusha, Ishvara, so too its power of consciousness appears to us in three aspects. It is the self-force of that consciousness, conceptively creative of all things, Maya. It is Prakriti, nature or force made dynamically executive, working out all things under the witnessing eye of the conscious being, the self or spirit. It is the conscious power of the divine being, Shakti, which is both conceptively creative and dynamically executive of all the divine workings. These three aspects and their powers base and comprise the whole of existence and all nature, and taken together as a single whole, they reconcile the apparent desperateness and incompatibility of the supracosmic transcendence, the cosmic universality, and the separativeness of our individual existence. The absolute cosmic nature and ourselves are linked in oneness by this triune aspect of the one reality. For taken by itself, the existence of the Absolute, the Supreme Brahman, would be a contradiction of the relative universe, and our own real existence would be incompatible with its sole incommunicable reality. But the Brahman is at the same time omnipresent in all relativities. It is the absolute independent of all relatives, the absolute basing all relatives, the absolute governing, pervading, constituting all relatives. There is nothing that is not omnipresent reality. In observing the triple aspect and the triple power, we come to see how this is possible.
So here Sri Aurobindo summarizes a lot of what we discussed, and primarily in this paragraph he is introducing the three other terms, the three the reflexive terms, that is Maya, Prakriti and Shakti. So he has already introduced the other three, but he makes them more manifest over here and reiterates what they are: self, conscious being or spirit, and God, Atman, Purusha and Ishvara, and then points out how they present what they present and how they are experienced, or how they experience the world. And so he puts it over here that the power of consciousness, ultimately the power of consciousness belongs to the self-conscious being. That's why we begin with the self-conscious being. There is one being who is self-conscious. But this is the entire notion of reflexivity, because if consciousness exists, then one of the inevitable realities of consciousness is its operation upon itself. It is self-conscious. And self-consciousness is action. Self-consciousness is creative. It already begins creating. Whatever it is conscious of becomes an existence. So that is what is symbolized in the Indian traditions by Shiva, who becomes the Ardhanarishvara, half male and half female, or half, being and half consciousness. And then we find that in these images of the Ardhanarishvara, the Nari part, or the feminine part, views itself in a mirror. It has a mirror in its hands. This mirror is the reflexivity of being. It's the self-reflexivity. It is that which brings the infinite into a certain frame of appearance. It appears to itself. And that self-appearance is occurring in three ways, because by that the infinite is coming into existence. So on the one hand, there is the idea of something supracosmic, that is infinite, that is indeterminable. On the other hand, there is a cosmos that has laws to it, that is ordered, but at the same time, the ordering of this cosmos has a root of chaos in it. It is as much chaos as it is order. It is both these at the same time, because the indeterminability of being permeates its determinations. And that's part of the reason why it is still whole in even its parts. So we find that goes all the way down to a point where everything seems to be working on some kind of habitual motion that nothing can change. There is either a randomness that is habitual, a habitual randomness, or a order that is habitual. And we can describe it in both of these ways. And each of these ways is ultimately something that you cannot control. It is the ground of things. And you can give an entire description to reality which is based upon consciousness emerging from this type of a bedrock. And when you do that, then we are talking about a consciousness that can observe and that can feel itself supporting. This operational aspect of the cosmos, but it cannot really create anything. It doesn't have power over that order. On the other hand, you can have a certain level where it is completely free and doesn't have any kind of relationship with this executive action. So these two poles that have led to so many philosophies, some which are dualistic and which say that there is an almighty, say for example in Islam, where we talk about an almighty that nevertheless has a certain kind of control, invisible control of the universe, but we can never know what that control is because we are permanently divided from it. Or we can talk about, like the Advaitins, a certain type of supracosmic absolute which coexists with a determinable universe but has no influence on it, does not interfere with it in any way. It exists only for us to escape out of this and enter into that. Or we can talk about these two realities as realities that have got some kind of a link that makes the one into the other. And this is the third position that is what Sri Aurobindo is taking. So for him, this is occurring through three levels of the relationship between being and its consciousness. At the highest level, consciousness is the consciousness of being, is the self-consciousness of being. And therefore, it can conceive of itself in infinite ways. Each of these self-conceptions is a cosmos and are the entities that enter into this cosmos. So the self-conception of the one is one way in which this relationship can be thought about. That is the relationship between Brahman and Maya. Maya is the one Brahman conceiving of itself as something. The idea of the one as idea, is Maya of Brahman. This Maya, however, is not overmind Maya. This is supramental Maya, the divine Maya, as Sri Aurobindo calls it in a chapter in part one. Now, at the other end of things, there is what we experience, which is what I defined as being a conscious being in an unconscious world, or what Sri Aurobindo calls being a living being in a living world. In either case, there is consciousness which finds itself in a world in which something is happening, phenomena are taking place. We are conscious of these phenomena taking place. And we realize that we support these phenomena from a certain point of view as an experiencer. In other words, we can put a stop to our own experience. We can say, I don't want this experience, and the experience will fall asleep, or it will disappear. Not that the phenomenon will disappear in the objective world, but to us, that particular phenomenon can disappear. But that support is one which is already sundered from the operations of the world. It can only watch it. This is the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti, which is, as he says, that between... let's see where it is here. Prakriti made dynamically executive, working out all things under the witnessing eye of the conscious being, the self or spirit. So the self witnesses, the fiat has already gone out, the Prakriti is in operation, it's, the machine is working, and Purusha is watching the machine as it works. So between these two ends, where the one has conceived of itself as idea at one end, and the other where that idea has become a machine that is at work, and the one has become an immanent witness to the working of the idea forces, between these two, is there a position in which the one is both idea and control of the workings of the machine by which the idea is manifesting itself? That is the third, the Ishvara Shakti relation. And that's why he says over there that he calls it, it is conscious power of the divine being, Shakti, which is both conceptively creative and dynamically executive of all the divine workings. Shakti, in this sense, is both Purusha and Prakriti. You see, it is both. It bridges Ishvara and Purusha, and is both Maya and Shakti and Prakriti.
I don't know about some other folks, but I'm just kind of having a challenge between the understanding the subtle differences, like, for example, between Shakti and Prakriti in this paragraph here. But I guess I'm just going to have to keep reading up on these definitions. Thinking about the words that you just said.
Yeah, you can think about it like this, Owen. I mean, look at those that one long line there, that sentence. He makes those three distinctions quite clear. I see. One, you see, because he talks about Maya as conceptive. In other words, Maya, conceptive meaning idea, it has an idea. So you can think about idea and execution. These are the two terms in which he defines Maya and Prakriti. Maya is idea, but as he says, it is real idea. In other words, not a mental idea, but it is idea as reality. Reality presenting itself through idea. That is Maya. Maya is a self-formulation of radically infinite being in terms of an idea, through the lens of an idea. And that idea includes space and time. So when it actually looks upon itself as a progressive idea, an idea that spans space and time, we immediately see that that idea has become an execution. The idea is working itself out. It is mapping itself in space, and it is evolving through time. Now, what is making that happen? That from the idea to the execution of the idea, there is a gap. The idea seems to be lost. That's also what the difference between what we call the transcendent and the immanent. In the immanent, there are certain forces that are expressing themselves as this cosmos. In the transcendent, there is only an idea. So between the two, what is both conceptive and executive at the same time? That is Shakti. So this is the difference. The difference is that between a conceptive reality and an executive reality, and that which is both conceptive and executive, holding the two together.
I see. So both conceptive and executive.
Exactly.
Could it be also said like three different poises of the same consciousness? That is, one is having that conception, that whole vision together. The other one is the execution, and the other one is their living, their presence together, like conception and the execution together, their presence of the two together. So three, could it be like three different poises of the same consciousness which is always there? Or?
Yeah, no doubt, absolutely. Just like there is only one Purusha, there is only one Shakti. Or we may go back and say, there is only Sat and there is only Chit, or there is only Sat with its own Chit. And these are modulating themselves in appearances, and these are the three appearances through which they appear.
Thank you.
Are three poises, you know, that the appearances are those poises, the three poises through which they appear. Now, the poise...
Devashish?
Yeah.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yeah, sure.
At the nexus of Prakriti, Shakti, and Maya, I find that this is kind of a dynamic intersection here. Is there anything that we could read in the synthesis of yoga that would speak to this this point here, this paragraph, and this aspect that you can think of?
Yeah, there is the chapter called Soul and Nature. I think it's in the Yoga of Works. There's a couple of chapters before and after it. And there's also in the fourth part, in the Yoga of Self-Perfection, there is, I'll find out exactly. Okay, let me see. I have the book here. I can refer you to the right chapters.
Somebody's keyboard is, is...
Hello. Oh, Devashish that went online. I'll just add him back.
Yeah, no, I'm here.
Oh, you're.
So, no, I was trying to find the chapters in answer to Owen's question. One second here. These are in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge. You see these chapters, it's part two, Yoga of Integral Knowledge. Firstly, there are this whole part which begins with the passive and the active Brahman, the difficulties of the mental being, that's 13. Then 14, the passive and the active Brahman. And then you have a few intervening chapters which are sort of relevant, but not totally relevant. Then chapter 17, the soul and nature. Chapter 17, the soul and nature. That's the principal one where he discusses these terms. And then all the close by chapters, the soul and its liberation, the planes of our existence, the lower triple Purusha, and the ladder of self-transcendence. All these are... very relevant to this.
But I guess I guess one of the difficulties we have all faced is also that those definitions also tend to be fluid, and he's also using them in different contexts. So unless we have read it all and we have a more scholarly understanding, it's very difficult that I found to just read a chapter and say this is what he means, because in a different place he's using it in a different way. Or those are words that are very normal words, but for those of us without that experience to back it up, it's almost always we kind of reverse engineer the meanings.
Yeah, but I think in The Life Divine, in this chapter, he makes some of these ideas much clearer. And then you can read that into the other places. Because one of the things about Sri Aurobindo, which happens even here, for example, when he uses three terms and then just translates them into the Sanskrit, those three terms, Atman, Purusha and Ishvara, he just translates them from three English terms. And without enough explanation, you see, because he is working with a very clear understanding that is his own. It takes a little time to really arrive at even what he calls a plastic understanding. Mm-hmm. But I think the plastic understanding is consistent. If you look at it in different places, there is a little, you may call it a locus rather than a focus. But even that locus is quite consistent. He uses it in the same way.
Thank you, Devashish.
I seem to have lost my page, but find it back.
327 and I think probably 285 or so on yours.
Yeah. Let's say 285 or so. Yeah, got it.
Joanna Zweig, would you like to read next?
Sure, I'm happy to read. Are we starting an absolute?
No, the next paragraph.
Okay. If we look at this picture of the self-existence and its works as a unitary limited whole of vision, it stands together and imposes itself by its convincing totality. But to the analysis of the logical intellect, it offers an abundance of difficulties, such as all attempts to erect a logical system out of a perception of an illimitable existence must necessarily create. For any such endeavor must either affect consistency by an arbitrary sectioning of the complex truth of things, or else by its comprehensiveness become logically untenable. For we see that the indeterminable determines itself as infinite and finite. The immutable emits a constant mutability and endless differences. The one becomes an innumerable multitude. The impersonal creates or supports personality, is itself a person. The self has a nature and is yet other than its nature. Being turns into becoming, and yet it is always itself and other than its becomings. The universal individualizes itself, and the individual universalizes himself. Brahman is at once void of qualities and capable of infinite qualities, the Lord and the doer of works, yet a non-doer and a silent witness of the workings of nature. If we look carefully at these workings of nature, once we put aside the veil of familiarity and our unthinking acquiescence in the process of things as natural, because so they always happen, we discover that all she does in whole or in parts is a miracle, an act of some incomprehensible magic. the being of the self-existence and the world that has appeared in it are, each of them and both together, a super-rational mystery. There seems to us to be a reason in things because the processes of the physical finite are consistent to our view and their law determinable. But this reason in things, when closely examined, seems to stumble at every moment against the irrational or infrarational and the suprarational. The consistency, the determinability of process seems to lessen rather than increase as we pass from matter to life and from life to mentality. If the finite consents to some extent to look as if it were rational, the infinitesimal refuses to be bound by the same laws, and the infinite is unseizable. As for the action of the universe and its significance, it escapes us altogether. If self, God, or spirit there be, his dealings with the world and us are incomprehensible, offer no clue that we can follow. God and nature and even ourselves move in mysterious way, which is only partially and at points intelligible, but as a whole escapes our comprehension. All the works of Maya look like the production of a super-rational magical power, which arranges things according to its wisdom or its fantasy, but a wisdom which is not ours, and a fantasy which baffles our imagination. The spirit that manifests things or manifests itself in them so obscurely looks to our reason like a magician, and his power or Maya a creative magic. But magic can create illusions, or it can create astounding realities, and we find it difficult to decide which of these super-rational processes faces us in this universe.
So this is another one of those paragraphs like the one on the Brahman, particularly the first part, that could be written down and presented as an Upanishad. You know, just the scope of the paradox that we are faced with. And he probes it to the point where everything becomes incomprehensible. And this is ultimately the big mental dilemma that humanity has been faced with throughout its history, and today more than ever before, because the whole notion of the world as an ordered entity, you know, it flounders against this incomprehensibility. It is exactly this. You know, vocity of both, on the one hand, some kind of a logos, a logical ordering to the universe, and a complete, a chaotic irrationality that underlies everything, and it just appears to be ordered. As soon as you look a little deep into it, as he points out, even at the level of the physical, if we go down to the infinitesimal, beyond the sort of measurable finites, we start hitting all kinds of paradoxes. And if we try to go towards the supracosmic or towards the infinite, it becomes even more irrational. Then he says how determinability decreases as freedom increases. You see, because that's exactly what we find, that the laws of matter seem to be bound because things are finite over there, but they sink into a certain substratum which throws those laws off, and then entering into the worlds of life and mind, we find that there is greater and greater indeterminability over there. So the question he asks at the end is that, how are we to take this as the production of a magician who produces completely out of a certain miraculous power, You know, I mean, this was Shankara's great excuse to the question, what is Maya? He says, somebody asked him that, well, what purpose would Brahman have in creating this illusory, illusion-producing, you know, faculty called Maya? And his answer was that Maya is so mysterious. It's such a kind of a creation of, you know, sort of irrational realities that we can never give an answer to that question. It will always remain a supra-rational mystery. So that is one way of looking at the universe. Once we, and he puts it so beautifully where he says, once we cast aside the veil of familiarity, see, if we look at these workings of nature, once we put aside the veil of familiarity and our unthinking acquiescence in the process of things as natural, because so they always happen. You see, we by habit, we take things, we adjust to things as they happen, and we assume that therefore they will always happen like that, and there are laws to everything. But if we probe it a little bit, we will discover that all she does, in whole or in parts, is a miracle, an act of some incomprehensible magic, because we don't arrive at whatever it is that is holding it all together. This is the point he's making. He's saying the Logos, if it exists, is not approachable by our logic. That there is, if the Logos exists, it is approachable only by another kind of logic. That logic belongs to the Ishvara Shakti relation of Brahman, of Sat and Chit. But we do not possess that. That's the basis of what he's saying. This is an intermediate paragraph. This is one of those paragraphs that if one stopped at this paragraph or just read it, you know, copied it and presented it, one could say that Sri Aurobindo is making the case for a mysterious cosmos with no comprehensibility to it. Completely indeterminable cosmos. But that's not what he's doing. He's presenting the case for it. That's all.
Does, Devashish, does this serve as some, as part of a foundation for the role of intuition and the other more ephemeral kinds of awarenesses in our psyche?
Yeah, indeed, you're quite right, Joanna. It forms a foundation for an argument through which he'll arrive at how are we to approach this root of order? How are we to intuit this root of order? How are we to take possession of that status of poise of being from which not a mental order but the intuition of the order of things manifests? Prakriti becomes Shakti. It is in possession of its concept. The real idea that has become this world is something which is visible as at the same time a knowledge will works through us. That is really, you're absolutely right. That's what he's trying to aim at, and he's preparing the ground for that.
Just regarding this acquiescence, there is a saying in of Einstein that's just thought of sharing. The important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. So that own reason for existing is what, you know, is the ultimate target of evolution, it seems.
Yeah, you see, so basically what that means, of course, you can read it in two ways. One is you could read it as, you know, curiosity is a human property that gives a definition to something essential in us, that whether it finds an answer or not fulfills us. That is one way of reading it. Another way of reading it is that this curiosity is an intrinsic component to the fabric of the cosmos itself, that the cosmos is a self-exploration, and that self-exploration is ultimately using us as an instrumental aspect of arriving at its own status of knowledge. See, of the logos that unfolds itself as concept and execution at the same time.
Beautiful, thank you. I'm glad that I brought it up.
Or shall we stop at this point and continue next week?
Yeah, or next time, which is probably in 2 weeks, right?
2 weeks.
What day would
that
be?
Yeah, the 27th.
Yeah.
So, will we read it, this, if we look at this picture of the self-existence, or we will start reading with the next chapter? I'm asking because of the website.
Yeah, I think what we'll do is, similarly, I'll give a short overview of what we've read, and we'll just start, because these paragraphs are so long. This chapter is one of those that he redid, and in these rewritten chapters, his paragraphs become very long. So I think instead of rereading it, I'll give a little overview, and then we'll start from "But in fact, the cause of this impression."
Okay, thank you.
We can read the last part of that paragraph and move on to the next paragraph.
Well, thank you, everyone. Stop here and continue on the
27th.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you.